Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. My guest today is Oregon's Attorney General Dan Rayfield. He grew up in Oregon with parents differing in political perspectives. His mother was a Green Party member, his father, a Republican. Dan went to Willamette Law School and spent 18 years in private practice with a focus on consumer protection. He served in the Oregon State Legislature representing the city of Corvallis and served on the House Ways and Means Committee before becoming Speaker. Last November, Dan was elected as the 18th Attorney General in Oregon history. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Well, thank you for having me, Mike.
Well, before you took office, you established a Federal Oversight and Accountability Cabinet. Why?
Yeah, I think, and I would say it was even before, and that was established in, I believe it was the end of November, early December. And really what I would take you back is through the entire presidential campaign. And during the campaign, you had the Trump administration talking about a lot of the things that they want to do, a lot of them fully within their power to do. There was a handful of things, and as we're seeing now, that were at odds with the Constitution, at odds with federal laws, and it really started perking the ears of attorney generals, also attorney general candidates such as myself along the way. And so we knew that there was this plan that the Trump administration had about what they wanted to accomplish, some of it valid, some not. And we wanted to be prepared because some of the things that you can have happen is there can be impacts in community that the government is not aware of. And so we wanted to create good channels of communication. We also wanted to bring the best legal minds together in one place where we could talk about different issues and ideas. And at the same time, we needed an ability to communicate more broadly within the state of Oregon, where the only person watching my Twitter account is my mother. And we needed a place to really be able to communicate into different communities that are being impacted, because there's a lot of misinformation that's going on right now. So this was a conduit for us to be able to do that, hold the Trump administration accountable, but at the same time, have better communication in our state, in communities.
Okay, and so who sits on your cabinet?
It's a wide-ranging group of folks. Where I said legal scholars, we have, one of my law professors back when I was in law school, and he, Norman Williams, and so he's a expert on administrative law. So we have a couple of legal scholars in that space, and then you run issues that were really talked about during the Trump administration campaign. So you have healthcare. So we have someone that represents hospital systems, our community coordinated care organizations are the folks that deliver your Medicaid in your communities. We have labor organizations, environmental organizations, and everything in between that you can imagine, from Planned Parenthood all the way down to Basic Rights Oregon, as there has been attacks across the board.
You have someone representing business economics?
So we have subgroups in different areas as well. And so we have been in regular contact with business. We also have, we've set up different organizations or different, what I would say, kind of subgroups for instance, like law enforcement. A really interesting dynamic that you have is, law enforcement and the techniques and the philosophies and viewpoints differ across the state. So what we really want to have in a time of chaos, uniformity. Business is another really key, important group to be talking to as well in this space. If you think about some of the policies and things that are going on right now are dramatically impacting folks, fascinating, in so many different unique ways that I don't think a lot of us anticipated. You have farmers that have planted crops in this country based upon food assistance, going to hungry citizens in our country, and the funding has been cut off. So you have those individuals. You have distributors in that food supply chain that are being impacted. And then, of course, you have the people who are experiencing hunger in that same space being impacted. So that was something, to be honest, without this communication in some of these areas, you really wouldn't learn about all of those impacts. Research dollars, fascinating. Oregon Health Sciences University, that's another area where we saw the National Institute of Health and some of the executive orders to cut off funding. These are places where we made significant advances in the MRI. Cancer research is going on in these places. So we really have to keep our pulse in all of these different places to understand the true impact to Oregon in these different communities and different, frankly, spaces.
And speaking of impact, You joined a number of other state attorneys general in participating in a series of community impact hearings. Why?
This is a really interesting point in time in our history. I think that it is an essential function of any government, right, whether it's state government or federal government, to evaluate how we spend our dollars to use our money efficiently, right? And we expect that as taxpayers. When I was in the legislature, I spent 4 years as the co-chair of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. And we would sit there, and every 2 years, we would examine our expenditures. We would make reductions. During the pandemic, we made significant reductions to balance our budget. And as a result, Oregon has one of the most healthiest budgets in the nation for a state. Federal government has that same responsibility, but you do that in a public process. You do that with eyes on things. You do it in a way where you can get feedback, because no legislator, no person in federal government is an expert in all of these different areas. You absolutely have to have public input to do your job properly. That's the foundation of our democracy, right? So what you've had happen recently is you've had the federal government making arbitrary cuts in these smoke-filled rooms with closed doors without public input. And so as Democratic attorneys general, what we wanted to do was elevate the voices that have not had an opportunity to be heard in this traditional democratic process. And the voices that have come up, I mean, these have been things, again, that I did not anticipate. You've had TSA agents come forward talking about how you're going to have safety issues, longer lines with the cuts that they're experiencing. I mentioned food safety issues. One of the things that was incredibly impactful for me when I listened was the impact to veterans' medical services. And so these community forums have been a wonderful area for people to elevate their voices. And frankly, what we're hoping to do is elevate them here, elevate them in our pushback against the Trump administration. So if they are going to make reductions, which they have some power to do so, they do them thoughtfully and with minimal impact to our citizens of this country.
My guest is Oregon's Attorney General Dan Rayfield. You can join the conversation by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So Oregonians are impacted by these attacks on the VA, on HUD, on Department of Ed. I mean, these are your veterans. I'm a veteran as well. This is an attack on affordable housing, the quality of our student education here in Oregon. But what do you hear from Oregon's electorate and elected leaders that support this administration?
It's interesting. I think it is. There's a two sides to this. One, if you are someone that supports the Trump administration, and there's plenty of people that do, and I think it's very important that we respect them in that process and their belief systems in that. I think it's very important. But at the same time, I think when you talk to those folks who do believe, right, and to be honest with you, if you were to talk to my father, he would say we do need to make reductions in government. And that is a valid viewpoint to hold in that space. What they will also say at the same time is that you have to do it in the way that the Constitution intended, in the way that Congress intended, right? We have these separation of powers. We all were taught this from, you know, our grade school days, that it's important that Congress stays in its lane, that it doesn't try to exercise executive power. It's important that the president stays within their powers. You are granted a ton of powers as a president of the United States, but you got to stick within your lane. I think that is what we're really starting to see emanate right now, is where some people may support the end with which the Trump administration may be trying to do. At the same time, some of the things that he's doing are going too far, right? For instance, eliminating the Department of Education, which will hurt vulnerable Oregonians, veterans services. I think when you start hearing folks a little bit more on the conservative scale, my dad is a veteran. We talked about this over a weekend, and it was incredibly bothering to both of us in this space and some of the impacts that are going on for real humans. And so how do you do that in a way that follows the separation of powers? And I think most Americans really believe that you got to follow the Constitution and you got to follow the law. And it doesn't matter whether you're a Democratic president or Republican president. If you're not doing that, you got to be held accountable. And that's really this dynamic, which I think creates an interesting tug and pull if you are someone that supports the Trump administration, right? You have to be able to, I think, support the end goal if you believe in that. But at the same time, you really need to make sure that your party is really following the rule of law, as both parties should, right? As a Democrat, I should make sure that our party is following the rule of law, too.
Well, the president takes an oath to faithfully uphold and execute the laws of the United States and defend the Constitution. But President Trump is intentionally violating that oath. He's ignoring the law and has even launched a direct attack on the 14th Amendment to the Constitution. So what can the top law enforcer in the state of Oregon do to protect Oregonians from the fallout of federal power being wielded this way?
Yeah, and this is exactly what we have been having to do. Within 24 hours of the Trump administration, we had our first lawsuit filed. In the first 6 months of the first Trump administration, no lawsuits had been filed. As we sit here today, 8 lawsuits have been filed. And I think here is the thing for people to, you know, in a time of chaos, to feel a little bit better about. We rely upon an independent judiciary, and I talk about an independent judiciary more than I ever thought I would have, you know, if you were to ask me 6 months ago. But you had Republican judges, Democratic judges holding the Trump administration accountable and saying, no, this is a violation of the Constitution. Just recently, I think it was 2 days ago, you had the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court push back against the president, a Chief Justice that was appointed by a Republican president. These are incredible times that are really stress testing our democracy, and it's increasingly important that you have attorneys general that are willing to file lawsuits and hold that Trump administration accountable. And it's increasingly important that we have a judiciary system that continues to exercise its independence from political pressure. And we're seeing that, and that is heartening. It doesn't mean that I agree with all the Supreme Court decisions, because I absolutely don't. It doesn't mean that I don't think it's being politicized or right now that the Trump administration is attacking it, because he is. But when push comes to shove right now, I have been encouraged to see judges at the district court level all the way up to the Supreme Court exercising some independence. And I think that's what we have to rely upon. It is that system of checks and balances that was really meant to prevent, you know, a monarchy, frankly.
Well, we have a couple of minutes before we have to take a quick break. You've joined other state attorneys general in suing the Trump administration. So tell us about the lawsuits that you're involved in.
Let's start off with the first 24 hours. The first 24 hours, the president signed an executive order trying to end birthright citizenship. And this was, as you mentioned a little bit earlier, Mike, this was ingrained in our 14th Amendment. And you had more than 120 years of differing presidential administrations interpreting this the exact same way. And with a stroke of the pen, the President Trump tried to reinterpret our Constitution. And you just can't do that. In fact, so that was our first lawsuit that was filed. And the judge up in Washington chastised the lawyers for the Trump administration, saying, how could they even sign pleadings like this with a straight face? It was that blatant in that dynamic. We've had to challenge, Elon Musk, Trump, when they come in trying to access our privacy information. We said, no, you do not have the ability to do that. We have attacked Elon Musk with how much power that he has been given without congressional approval in that space. And so we have a lawsuit there. We have a lawsuit on gender-affirming care and making sure that everybody is treated equally in our state and in our country. There's the funding freezes that we're seeing. We've attacked those because they were done unconstitutionally, and frankly, they need congressional approval. And it is, he's trying to assume the role of Congress and president at the same time, and our Constitution says you can't do that. There's been the dismantling of the Department of Education, right, where you lay off half of the employees, which is constructively kills that agency and impacts disadvantaged students across this country. So you have a whole host of these lawsuits that have been filed. What I would tell you is that in the first Trump administration, Democratic attorneys general, I think, were winning 80% of those lawsuits. Right now, we have gotten favorable rulings in almost all of those cases, moving forward, because we're trying to be very thoughtful in which cases we bring and respecting the fact that the executive branch does have power. But when you exceed it, it's our responsibility to hold them accountable. So those are just a handful of the cases that we've really started to work on.
Okay, well, we need to take a short break, and I want to get into that accountability issue when we get back. My guest is Oregon's Attorney General Dan Rayfield. I'm Mike Green. You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of JPR. Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. My guest is Oregon's Attorney General Dan Rayfield. He has joined a coalition of state attorneys general in hosting a series of community impact hearings to listen to the outcry from Americans adversely impacted by federal policies. You're welcome to join the conversation by email at jx@jeffnet.org. I want to start this part of the segment with a simple question. Will you host a community impact hearing in Southern Oregon?
I am very interested in hosting multiple community impact hearings. We're in the process of scheduling them, and we do not have the dates of the locations set up. But I am incredibly interested in doing that. We're going to be down in the Southern Oregon area here in the near future for a couple of reasons. So we're exploring all those options. So, and we might even try and do something in Eastern Oregon as well. But again, we're still in the early phases of getting things done and given all of the schedule demands.
Okay. We look forward to continuing our conversation when you come here. The impact of Trump policies are felt at the moment that a decision is carried out. And you mentioned all these lawsuits, but the lagging of the lawsuits in these courts, I don't think they adequately compensate for the damage done to people's lives, even if you win months or years later. And I think that seems to be understood by this administration and their tactics. And so the bottom line is an erosion of trust. And I'm wondering, how can we trust the systems, the laws, the lawmakers, and the law enforcers when we're witnessing a widespread breach of trust by those who we elect to safeguard the institutions and the laws? Who can we trust?
Mike, you bring up an incredibly impactful point. And sometimes there's not always direct answers to how do we turn around from some of these things. I always feel that if you have to engage the legal system, something has already gone significantly wrong. And we can't deny that. Sometimes the legal system can be used to prevent things from occurring. But to your exact point, once you break that trust, it takes time to rebuild it, and that is going to require an enormous amount of effort upon all elected leaders, right? All Oregonians need to know that their Democrats and their Republicans are working for them and working on behalf of them, and sometimes it doesn't feel like that today. So I think that is an incredibly important thing. The one thing that I have learned through, we had a impact hearing with federal workers with the congressional delegation, and so a big thank you to Senator White and Senator Merkley for setting that up in Portland. And it was fascinating to hear, and something that I knew but just hadn't heard it articulated that way, that there is going to be a chilling impact for people who seek federal employment. So against a broad range of things, because there's so much uncertainty. So whether that is your TSA agent, whom we've heard from, whether that is from your USDA folks that are looking about food safety, which we've heard from, whether it's people working in the Veterans Administration, people are nervous about staying in those roles and then, frankly, seeking those roles down in the future due to this uncertainty. I think that's something that is, you know, that's a microcosm of a much bigger issue that you've identified, which is really all of us as citizens of this country and the trust that we have as we start seeing things being pulled back. And that, in my opinion, is going to take time and concerted effort, just like in any relationship we have, you know, with our friends or our family, right? We have, as elected officials, have to earn and build that trust back. And that is going to take time.
Well, let's talk about the uncertainty and let's talk about federalism. How can the states, like Oregon, protect their residents from an abuse of federal power when we live in this uncertain time?
Well, I think we all have different roles in a democracy. This very early on stage, right, where you've seen the executive orders, you have seen to defend Oregon citizens. That has had a heavy reliance upon the Department of Justice. And I should always say that the work that we do at the Department of Justice is a result of all of the people who work there, not just me. It's like, while I may be sitting there, and have my picture on a website, you have incredible people within the Department of Justice who support and make sure that this work is getting done to protect all Oregonians. And so they deserve an enormous amount of credit with their vision, their leadership, and their legal acumen across the board. And we have a ton of folks that are not lawyers within the Department of Justice that deserve the same amount of credit in that space. So we always should recognize the people that really help and are looking out for all Oregonians, and it's a team effort in this space. And so we have really taken the brunt of this first, what I would say, onslaught from the Trump administration. We will continue to do that. You have an ongoing legislative session which in the state, which has a different set of tools and limited resources, right? So, for instance, if we see food assistance reduce in our communities, and hunger is a big issue in our state, the state legislature will look to see how much can they backfill to kind of support that. What I would say is that there is so much need in our state in some of these areas, we're not going to be able to fully backfill the gap that the federal government is going to leave. Then you have, as things shift into administrative rules, we will sit here as the Department of Justice and continue to push back and hold them accountable to make sure they're following the rule of law. Then it will shift into a lot of the things that are going on federally that the Trump administration is trying to do and doing illegally by violating the Constitution. They will try to do some of these things through Congress, and it's going to be imperative with our congressional delegation to stand up and fight for us in that capacity, which they are, and they're doing a very good job. The challenge for us right now is that you have a Republican-controlled Congress. And that is incredibly daunting. But what I really expect to see for these next 2 years, these battles to unfold as we shift from executive orders, administrative, the state legislature will play a role, the congressional delegation will play a role, and then there's a role all of us in our communities have. Okay, and this is the thing that we can't forget. In a democracy, all of our voices matter incredibly. That's why these community hearings matter. That's why we need to make sure that our voices in Oregon and the impacts to our neighbors, right, who are just going to work, trying to get through the day, to make sure that everybody is talking about this and is aware of the gravity. I think that's very important.
My guest is Oregon's Attorney General Dan Rayfield. You can add your questions or comments by email at jx@jeffnet.org. I agree with you. I think that everyone's voice is important, and I appreciate your effort to bring the voices together. So now let's talk about the elephant in the room. I want you to give me a second here, because I keep hearing this euphemism called culture war. And President Trump and his, quote, army of conservatives, end quote, as they're referred to in Project 2025, have executed a coordinated attack on diversity, equity, and inclusion, or DEI, civil rights, voting rights, the education of children, in what they derisively call wokeism, and the 14th Amendment, which transformed black people on this continent into black American citizens in 1868. And as a student of history, sir, it is hard for me to ignore the fact that these are all components of the collective effort of black Americans to develop a path of progress toward equitable ownership of the American dream of prosperity, which dates back to the Civil War. So this blatant priority on rolling back the incremental progress that generations of black Americans and their white allies sacrificed their lives for isn't even part of the national discourse, nor do we have public convenings about the state of race relations in this state of Oregon, which has its own history steeped in white supremacy. So what can you do in your capacity as AG to elevate awareness and initiate a conversation in our state about the core racial elements in these assaults on the law that are unresolved and being ignored?
we are doing is one thing, and what we can be doing is kind of the second part to your question. We are in the spaces that we occupy, whether that is in a courtroom or whether that is in community, we're doing our best to bring voices together. So we mentioned at the very beginning the Federal Oversight and Accountability Program. We have included voices from all communities in that workgroup to make sure that we are listening and hearing and that our information and that their information is moving back and forth in that space. Is that enough? Absolutely not. But it is a start to what we're able to do in an incredibly chaotic and busy time. A next part of that conversation, you know, is there's this long-term element of how systematically these rights are being attacked. And it's being done in a way where they're purposely branding and polarizing language in society to get responses out of people. And so I think you see that in the way that the Trump administration, the Trump campaign used its communication machine to really weaponize certain terminology and language and pit people against each other. I think it's incumbent upon us to really go back to what are the fundamentals that we all agree upon. And there are simple things that are ingrained within the Constitution. I think we need to, and you spoke about this more articulately than I've heard most people speak about it. And there are common terms when we think about what does our Constitution stand for. What I really believe is that when you're talking to a Democrat or a Republican outside of this political echo chamber that we often advocate, but if you're in your living room, if you're out at dinner and we talk about, don't you believe that every American should be treated equally? Don't you believe that everybody should have a fair opportunity in this world? In the way that we talk about some of these things, there is unanimity there, but we have been weaponized with some of this terminology. The path back, I think, is what you're really identifying, is how do you elevate those conversations and what is the responsibility for each elected official to then elevate those conversations? And I think this is something that a lot of us are beginning to start to do in our own individual lanes, right? Whether it is in your area, Senator Golden or Representative Pam Marsh, right? What are in their areas? They're incredible people. How are they elevating that into you? What is my responsibility as elected official to use my soapbox to start, convene, and have these conversations? And these are things that we are beginning to do in the first couple months of our administration. But what I will tell you is there's going to be a lot of other really good ideas and ways that we'll continue to do that over time that we probably haven't thought of. But I think it's incredibly important that as we're thinking about it, it's very easy for me to sit in a very in an office and come up with my own ideas. I think it's more important that we convene tables and hear from people about how we can better engage with the tools and resources we have, which is part of the reason that we put together that Federal Oversight and Accountability, is to sit there and listen and to gather ideas. One of the vacuums that we realized and we've been stepping out of, and I apologize, this answer is going long. I think it's an incredibly important question, is we have stepped out in non-traditional ways for the Department of Justice. We have had to put toolkits and community organizing in different ways the Department of Justice has not always done. And again, an incredible credit to the people at the Department of Justice to get out into community, talk about making sure people are understanding, to your point, the history and genesis of a lot of these issues that are going on right now in our community. And we've begun doing that in very non-traditional ways. We have a website you can search Department of Justice, Oregon Department of Justice toolkits, and you will see different ways where we're trying to get out into community and make sure that people have information. I don't think that's enough. And we're still looking for different ways to be, with limited resources, how we can be better in our own roles.
Well, we all inherited this society from a 20th century of racial segregation as laws, systems, public policies, and private sector practices. So we didn't create it. We just inherited. So no blame, no shame. But we also inherited a responsibility for the society that we pass to future generations. So I appreciate the work that you're doing. Absolutely. And my last question, and we've got about a minute and a half. Across the nation, many of the law enforcement agencies, as well as here in Oregon, are impacted by the executive branch leveraging the power of the Department of Justice. We witnessed the break-in at the Institute of Peace using local law enforcement in D.C. What is the policy here in Oregon for local law enforcement when the state and federal government don't agree?
So one of the things right now in the way that you think about, and let's talk about sanctuary state laws really quick, and I don't know how we do that in a minute and a half, but really the idea behind that is that we have local law enforcement for local purposes, right? Enforce our theft laws, burglary, murder in this space, the things that are going on in community. Federal law has different federal laws and different responsibilities, and they have a different law enforcement entities and agencies to enforce those federal laws. They're separate and distinct. And we stay in our lane, they stay in their lane. And it's important, actually, for community safety in the enforcement of, to make sure that our law enforcement officers are not enforcing federal laws. And I could go into that. And so there is this distinct role, and it's established, and it's been well established, those roles for more than seven presidential administrations. There's never been conflict in that space.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there, unfortunately. That's all the time we have, sir. So sorry. I wish we could do this, and we will do it. Thank you, Dan Rayfield.
Thank you, Mike. I really appreciate it.